This is a podcast from Deutsche Welle. For more information and a selection of other programs, click on to dwworld.de.
Deutsche Welle. World in progress.
On today's program, fear of more conflict and displacement ahead of South Sudan's independence.
They tied me up with a rope and they beat me. When I tried to escape, they cut me on the back with a machete.
Gay Muslims in Indonesia fighting for their right to be different.
If I have a choice, I wouldn't want to become a transsexual. But that's what God decided for me. So I accept this and thank God for that.
And Persian-Swedish band Abjiz speak up against political and social problems.
We realize that it's a little bit risky for us to go back. Because we are women, it's illegal for us to sing, and the issues we are singing about are mostly political.
Hello and welcome to World in Progress. I'm Anke Rasper in Bonn. As southern Sudan edges closer to independence from the north on July the 9th, many communities are still living in fear, and there is a risk of escalating violence. The town of Abyei, on the border between the north and south, was seized by northern forces following clashes with South Sudanese troops. Thousands of people fled their homes, and the disputed status of the city is now threatening a peaceful transition to independence. Further south, security remains fragile in border regions where the Lord's Resistance Army is active. As Guy Degen reports, many villages in the state of Western Equatoria are trying to cope with the ongoing threat of the LRA.
Thirteen-year-old Charles lowers a large bucket into a shallow hole and scoops up brown brackish water to bring home for washing, a daily chore to help his family. Charles's village is very close to dense bush along southern Sudan's border with the Democratic Republic of Congo. And it was on an ordinary day like this in January last year that Charles was abducted with five others by the Lord's Resistance Army while tending to his family's crops.
They tied me up with a rope and they beat me. When I tried to escape, they cut me on the back with a machete.
The Lord's Resistance Army is a northern Ugandan militia led by Joseph Kony and roams the borders of southern Sudan, Central African Republic and DRC. For more than 20 years, the LRA have terrorized communities, looting, killing, raping, abducting women for sexual slaves or bushwives, and forcing children to become soldiers. Charles says the LRA soldiers who captured him were moving quickly and released the women as they marched through the bush. Eventually, he managed to escape with another boy who had been held by the LRA for more than 3 years.
I was very happy to see my mother. When my mother saw me, she ran up to me and hugged me and started crying. I kept praising God that he had protected me.
Charles was first brought to a transit center for abducted children in the town of Yambio. The center provides the children with medical care and specialized counseling and begins tracing their family. Justin Abera is the director of the center. He says children abducted by the LRA are often severely traumatized by beatings, sexual abuse, or having been forced by the LRA to kill their family.
They kill immediate relation, like their father or brothers or mother. Just the motive is to make them fear from escaping to come back to the society. It is like they are closing them. They are sealing them off from the community, not to return back to the community.
And even though some may not be given firearms, Ebere says the LRA conditions children to kill.
They orient them towards serious violence, murder, and all the skills of killing. Because they have to, their life in the bush depends on how, the skills you have to kill.
In a village just a short distance from Yambio, 12-year-old Grace is helping her mother wash dishes. Their small and simple mud hut sits beside a shady mango tree. For Grace, every day with her family is cherished. In 2009, she and several others in her village were abducted at gunpoint by the LRA. As they were marched through the bush, the LRA killed the adult men.
We continued walking and we heard gunshots. They said if we tried to escape, we'd be killed.
Grace was held in captivity by the LRA for nearly a year, forced to carry heavy loads and suffered beatings and abuse. She was shot in the leg when Ugandan soldiers attacked an LRA campsite. Unable to run away, Grace was rescued by Ugandan soldiers and eventually reunited with her family. Esther, her mother, says Grace is still deeply troubled by the experience.
She is very moody. Sometimes she's silent and doesn't want to cooperate. She just gets so angry, as if someone has annoyed her. And when she gets in that mood, she doesn't want anyone to ask her what happened with the LRA.
The ongoing threat of attacks by the LRA in this part of southern Sudan continues to displace tens of thousands of people. Villagers from Sangwar near Nazara say they're unable to go back to their homes or work their crops, and they rely on support from international NGOs in a makeshift camp. They also talk of the terrifying LRA attack on their village. This woman says when the LRA attacked them in the morning, she managed to grab her youngest child but had to leave behind another toddler. She did not witness it, but believes her child was killed with other babies, pounded to death in a large wooden mortar. Congolese and Ugandan forces have pursued Joseph Kony and the LRA across borders in the region. However, Human Rights Watch say they lack adequate capacity to react quickly. The United States is also committed to help protect civilians threatened by the LRA, but human rights groups are urging the US and the United Nations to do more. Except for a home guard militia known as the Arrow Boys, remote communities are largely defenseless. There are some 3,000 Arrow Boys in western Equatoria, armed with only bows and arrows, spears, and an assortment of homemade shotguns. From their patrols, they also provide intelligence to the government on LRA movements. Against a more heavily armed LRA, they rely on their local bush knowledge. One of the Arrow Boy leaders, Gemenze William John, says his men are not afraid of fighting the LRA.
So the LRA have machine gun when we meet them. So we can do our best as Arrow Boys. We are using our arrows. With my arrow, I can do it because I'm fighting for my land.
With the status of Abia under dispute, sporadic internal fighting in other regions, as well as the continual threat posed by the LRA, South Sudan is likely to have a difficult birth on July 9. The people of the world's newest nation have already endured decades of conflict and violence. Despite the South Sudanese struggle for independence, peace and security remains far from certain. Guy Deegan, Deutsche Welle Radio, Yambio, Southern Sudan.
Millions of people are internally displaced in countries around the world. But nowhere do so many people have to flee their homes as in Colombia. More than 5 million internal refugees live in this South American country, where drug gangs are the biggest enemy. The armed groups take farmers' land, and fighting back can be lethal. Human rights activist Diego Espitia has taken on the drug barons and is now in fear for his life. The Colombian government has put him into its protection program. José Ospina went through a series of strict security checks to meet him, and Gabriel Borod presents his report.
I'm sitting in an armored sport utility vehicle that belongs to the Colombian Interior Ministry. The driver is racing through Medellin's traffic. A bulletproof vest peeks out from under his shirt. The bodyguards next to me have checked my ID and questioned me several times. Now no one in the vehicle feels like talking anymore. We're on the way to visit one of Colombia's most sought-after people. Diego Espitia has fought for years from his home in Colombia's Uraba region. Hundreds of thousands of people have had to leave their homes and villages there. The drug mafia is particularly interested in the region. The old forests along the narrow stretch of land offer the protection they want when transporting cocaine between the Atlantic and Pacific. That has made the fight for control of this region especially vicious. Espitia has had to leave his home. He knew too much about the drug boss's plans. The vehicle stops in front of a cafe, and I meet Diego Espitia. He's a young man who looks surprisingly gentle. A bodyguard is sitting right next to him. Another one is walking around the cafe. Espitia starts the conversation with an apology.
La lengua, por eso hablo así, porque me la mutó en dos pedazos.
A shot split my tongue. That's why I'm having so much trouble speaking clearly. My tongue is too short, kind of like a parrot. They knew I'd be wearing a bulletproof vest, so they aimed at my head.
The they he's talking about are the drug lords in the part of the country he comes from. Hired killers shot at him last year, but Espitia was lucky. He survived. Espitia knows, however, that his killer could still be right around the next corner. Still, the 25-year-old continues to fight for the people the drug gangs are forcing from their homes. But he pays the price. He is accompanied by the Interior Ministry bodyguards everywhere he goes, 24 hours a day. Since he was shot, Espitia has lived in a witness protection program. The expulsions of people from Uraba began with subtle threats. When the locals didn't leave, the threats got less and less subtle, Espitia says.
A woman watched her husband get killed. Before they did it, they came again and told him he had a choice, either sell his land himself or have his widow sell it at an even lower price.
Diego tried to help. He moved in with families in the region. For months, he lived in the houses that drug lords were trying to take over. He told the people living there about their rights and told officials about the gang's activities. But in the end, much of his work was in vain.
When they took away our land, they came with guns. They dragged us violently out of the houses. They took away our land because they needed it to transport their drugs.
Many of the families driven off their land had been living in Uraba for generations. For them, it was unthinkable to start a new life in the nearby city, Medellin. Most of the people had never been to school and only knew farming. So they ended up moving back to their land, the same land the drug gangs took away from them.
We tried to take back the farmers' land, all together. We moved back into the houses. Right away, we started planting maize, yucca, and rice. We thought if we showed our determination, the paramilitaries would stay away. That's what we thought.
But Espitia and the farmers were wrong. The drug gangs came back, and this time they have government support. The gangs filed charges against the farmers, accusing them of illegally reclaiming the land.
Once the mayor even came with the police. There were 280 of us and 200 police. They came in full riot gear and fired tear gas at us to get us to break up.
Finally, the farmers gave up. Most now live in the slums around Medellin. But Diego Espitia is still fighting. He founded an organization for those driven from their land and continues to tell the world about the farmers' plight. For his efforts, the drug lords have put a price on his head and vowed never to leave him alone. Espitia can't even decide whom he meets with anymore or where he eats and sleeps. His bodyguards do all that now. They just try to keep him alive.
And this report by José Ospina about human rights and drug gangs in Colombia was the first in a series on human rights across the world, which World in Progress will bring to you over the next few weeks. Coming up next here on the program, the development news with Hannah Wandel.
EU aid policy to target fewer states and good governance. European aid to poorer countries should focus on fewer recipient states and be increasingly linked to democratic advancements, according to a forthcoming review of the EU's development policy. The tougher criteria reflects increasing strain on European budgets, booming economies in Asia and Latin America, and a shift in donor thinking following the Arab Spring. A recent overhaul of the European Neighbourhood Policy also proposed a tightening of funding criteria after years of EU financial support to North African states failed to bring about democratic reforms, the EU paper says. UN to give Bangladesh $1.8 billion for development. The United Nations has made an agreement with Bangladesh for $1.8 billion over the next 5 years to support the poor nation in addressing development problems. The agreement, known as the United Nations Development Assistance Framework 2012 to 2016, aims to help Bangladesh in achieving Millennium Development Goals by focusing on various priority areas. The areas include democratic governments and human rights, pro-poor growth, social services, food security and climate change, the environment, disaster risk reduction, urban development and gender equality. Syria killings, likely crimes against humanity. Killings and torture by Syrian security forces in the southern city of Daraa over the past 2 months may qualify as crimes against humanity, according to Human Rights Watch. In a statement on Wednesday, the watchdog said more than 50 interviews with victims and witnesses indicate systematic killings, beatings, torture using electric shock devices, and detention of people seeking medical care. It said that the nature and scale of the abuses strongly suggest that these qualify as crimes against humanity. In Syria, protests have raged against President Bashar al-Assad's regime since mid-March. HRW said Syrian security forces used deadly force against protesters and civilian bystanders. It's estimated that at least 1,000 protesters have been killed by government forces.
And that was Hannah Wandel with the development news. In Indonesia, homosexuality is not outlawed, but the Islamic Indonesian Ulema Council has declared it evil or haram. In Indonesian society, gays, lesbians and transgender Muslims are often made to feel unwelcome in mosques and Islamic schools. But in a quiet street in the ancient Javanese city of Yogyakarta, Mariani, a 50-year-old transsexual hairdresser, has turned part of her salon into an Islamic school. Here is one place that gay, lesbian and transgender Muslims can pray and discuss their religion in safety, as Rebecca Henschke discovered when she visited Mariani.
It's almost 6 p.m. and time for the evening prayer. Mariani's hairdressing salon is being transformed. Mirrors are being hidden behind embroidered drapes. Prayer mats are being spread out over the tiled floor. And copies of the Al-Quran are replacing fashion magazines.
Tonight we are praying with 90 orphans and poor women from a nearby village. It's my 50th birthday today and I want to thank God for giving me that time on earth. I will be called by God in the not-too-distant future, so I have to do the right thing.
Mariani was abandoned at birth and adopted by a Roman Catholic family in the ancient Javanese city of Yogyakarta.
From when I was a young child, I always played with girls' toys, and I knew very early on that I had the heart and spirit of a woman.
Tonight, Mariani looks like a typical Indonesian housewife. She's wearing a simple long dress and a headscarf with no makeup. But photos around the salon reveal a different side of her life. In one I've come to here, she's wearing her slinky, off-the-shoulder, cream evening dress and heavy makeup, bright red lipstick and blue eyeshadow, as well as diamond earrings.
I was 20 when I decided to dress like a woman. I had my heart broken when my boyfriend married a woman. It was then that I started meeting with other transsexuals and entered the dark night world. I sold my body on the streets to survive. I traveled across Indonesia, working in the popular transsexual beats. It was so I could survive.
Transsexuals, or waria as they're known in Indonesia, do have limited job opportunities. The people I'm meeting with tonight tell me they work as prostitutes or they busk by dancing and singing on the streets for a little bit of money, or they work in hairdressing salons like this one.
Being a transsexual is not a choice. If I have a choice, I wouldn't want to become a transsexual. But that's what God decided for me, so I accept this and thank God for that. When I was young, I didn't want to live a good life, but as I got older, I realized that selling my body was wrong. So I slowly saved money and opened this hairdressing salon and returned to the path of God.
So by this time you'd converted to Islam, and many Muslim leaders, including the country's Ulama Council, say that transsexuals like yourself, gays and lesbians, are sinful, dirty, and are not accepted by God. What is it about Islam that attracts you?
Semua agama itu baik.
All religions are good. It's humans who are not, but Islam just felt right in my heart. Even though some ulemas say that our prayers will not be answered, that we are not accepted by God, I believe that we have every right as humans to pray. We are not praying to be healed or turned back into men. No. Praying is our business with God, not with other humans.
Saya juga manusia dan tidaknya itu urusan saya kepada Tuhan.
Saya mengucapkan terima kasih sekali.
Mariani has just addressed the crowd and explained why she set up this Islamic school in the back of her salon 2 years ago. To create a space, she says, where one evening a week, gay, lesbian and transsexual Muslims can practice their faith in safety. She asked the orphans through tears to respect transvestites' rights, to pray, to enter mosques, and to also earn a living. The evening quarter prayer rings out from the nearby mosque, and the leader of prayer service here. They're rolling out some prayer mats. One of them is Nofi. She has varnished fingernails and long black hair. But she's praying tonight as a man, wearing a green checkered sarong and a long white shirt. She says she feels more comfortable praying as a man, but during the day, and in her own sense and in her heart, she's a woman. She attended an Islamic school, but there she says she had to dress as a man and hide her true self. But here and tonight, she doesn't have to do that.
My hope is that with this Islamic school that the general public will see that the transsexuals are not bad people. We have skills and can contribute to society. We can dance and do makeup, but we can also teach the Quran. God sees what is inside us and hears our prayers. He doesn't care about what's on the outside.
For Deutsche Welle Radio, this is Rebecca Henschke in Central Java, Indonesia.
And in our last report today, we meet an unusual band who call themselves Abjis. That's a Persian slang word for sisters, and Abjis is also the name of a Swedish-based band fronted by two sisters from Iran. Safura and Melody Safawi were born in Tehran, but the family fled the country during the Iran-Iraq War and came to Sweden as refugees. Growing up in a new country and learning new languages gave the sisters a different perspective. Abjis sing about the fight for democracy in Iran, war, arranged marriage, displacement and the difficulties immigrants face. Backed by a multicultural mix of talented musicians, they've created an energetic blend of musical styles and languages, singing in Persian as well as Swedish, Spanish and in English. Due to the political nature of some of their songs, Abjis has been banned in Iran, but they have a strong underground following and one day hope to perform in their home country. Cinnamon Nippert caught up with Safura and Melody before their Berlin show.
Last time we went to Iran was in year 2003, and we haven't been back ever since, because since we formed the band and got some media attention, we realized that it's a little bit risky for us to go back. Because we are women, it's illegal for us to sing, and the issues we are singing about are mostly political and social critical. So it's not a good time to go back right now.
That's Melody Safavi, one of the lead singers of Abjis. Despite being banned in Iran, Abjis stays in contact with friends, family and fans through Facebook and other social media. Watching the first mass demonstrations in Iran after the last presidential elections inspired Safura and Melody to write the song Bia.
Lay down your weapon.
At that time, the government hadn't started their crackdowns the way they did later. So in this song, we are inviting the armed forces to put down their weapons and join the masses of people. But the day we posted this song on YouTube was the same day that the massive crackdown happened, and they killed so many people, including this young woman, Neda Ara Sultan. And it was really a very, very horrible experience. And I told Safra, had we wrote this song just 2 or 3 days later, it would have sounded completely different.
Abjis were angry and disappointed at the oppression by the Iranian authorities. But Safra Safavi, lead singer and guitarist from Abjis, says that the recent uprisings this year in the Middle East have given them renewed hope for change.
I think what happened in Iran might have inspired a lot of other countries nearby. And in the same way, what has happened in the other countries and what Egypt has achieved is giving strength again to the people in Iran. A lot of them maybe felt disappointed that they couldn't make greater change, but now they have got new energy, like it is possible. We just have to continue believing and struggling for our human rights.
Safra and Melody are grateful that their parents chose to leave Iran because they've had a lot of opportunities and experiences that they wouldn't have had under a dictatorship. Safra first started writing songs as a teenager and studied music in other countries, while Melody took up social work in Sweden, helping young people with drug and alcohol problems. She then became a linguist and media research specialist working in the United States. However, it was the band's video clip of their anti-war song, Democracy, that unexpectedly caught the attention of Melody's employer, Voice of America. They fired her.
There are scenes from the Iraq War, and it shows how both American soldiers and the Iraqi people are victims of a very unjustified war. So we were condemning war, not America, not the soldiers.
But not all of Abjis's songs are political. They also write about love and different cultural aspects in smart, direct and playful ways. At their Berlin show, the crowd was diverse. Young people, old people, Iranians and non-Iranians, all dancing and having a great time. What's interesting about Abjis fans is that they're all passionate about the band for different reasons.
They mix a lot of different styles of music from all over the world. Like you have that flamenco sort of thing, you have Persian elements, reggae, you have salsa muffin, a little bit of rock. So it's extremely globalized music.
They are great musicians, and the sense of humor is the kind of thing which I like very much as a Persian guy who understands and speaks Persian.
It impressed me a lot when they made a song about the movement in Iran, you know.
I think this is the one and only band which can represent me and my nation after the revolution 1979. This is about the people who moved away from Iran and grown up out of Iran and grown up with a lot of languages and cultures, and they represent it in their music, and I like it very much, and it represents a part of me.
Like many Iranian musicians and artists in exile, Abjis hope that one day they'll be able to perform in their home country. Cinnamon Nippard, Deutsche Welle Radio, Berlin.
And that brings us to the end of this week's program. Do join us again at the same time next week. I'm Anke Raspar, and on behalf of the World in Progress team here at Deutsche Welle in Bonn, thanks for tuning in and goodbye for now.
shanira irin kane baninir gaba.
You've been listening to a podcast from Deutsche Welle. We hope you enjoyed the program. You'll find more information and podcasts at dwworld.de.